Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shirtless. This show is heard on WBCQ every Monday and Thursday evenings at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You could also pick it up on our Podomatic page, podomatic.com, and just put in Camp Constitution. We have not all of our shows there, but many of our shows, especially those that I think are the better ones. You can also go to our YouTube channel, and you could find our videos, our radio shows that we convert to YouTube video and upload them, as well as many other things. Our YouTube, we have well over 1,000 videos. And the show is brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And we very much hope that we'll be able to get our camp run our camp this year with all kinds of cancellations. We've already canceled a homeschool show, two homeschool shows that we were going to be, and many other events, but God willing, we will still hold our family camp from July 19th to the 24th in Plainfield, New Hampshire at the Singing Hills Christian Camp and Retreat Center. So please visit our website to learn more about our camp, campconstitution.net. Now we have a guest on the line, Mr. Leo Loving. How you doing, Leo?
Fine, Hal. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you, on this beautiful, overcast, early spring day. We're hanging in there, my family and I. Thankfully, the only business that's been shut down is besides Camp Constitution, as far as our activities. We're still busy doing things online and getting the house up in Lexington, our learning center, ready for it's already open, but you know, we hope to have some great programs there. And but we're hanging in there. So I got a call from Leo about a week ago, thanking me for uploading a video that we'll be talking about that he produced he produced many years ago. It was the topic of John Birch. Now, I had probably served as a full-time field rep for the John Birch Society for 26 years, so I have lots of admiration for the man who had an organization, a patriotic organization named in his honor. So, Leo, tell us a little bit about your background before we go into the documentary and John Birch.
Sure. I'm glad to be speaking to you this morning from Elgin, Illinois, a west suburban town of Chicago, and I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, and worked for 43 years for corporate America, most of those years as accountant for an oil and gas company, and retired in the year 2000. I am now 81 years of age, and I am still trying to get a movie, a feature film made about U.S. Army Captain John Morrison Birch, one of my all-time favorite heroes.
Well, you know, Robert Welch, who wrote a book called The Life of John Birch, he had a friend in the U.S. Senate, Senator Nolan from California. And so I think he somehow got access to the file on John Birch and was just so moved about his story that when he formed the organization some years later, he looked at John Birch as the best of America's manhood, as young. He was a young Christian. He loved the Lord. He put his life on the line for others. And he saw him the best of America's manhood. What was it about John Birch that got your attention?
Well, it was just exactly what you mentioned. He represents the best of America. His courage, his determination to do the right thing for God and country drove him to uncanny excursions into a military life for the United States Army Air Force that garnered him numerous medals and gave us an appreciation of just what real patriotism is.
Can you give us a good biographical sketch of John Birch from his early days, from his days at college, and then on to the missionary field? tell us a little bit. So just give us a, you get the floor. You can just give us a nice little historical overview of this great man.
All right. Well, I'll do the best I can here. John was born in Lander, India, to missionary parents, May the 28th, 1918. And because of his father's health situation, he had contracted malaria, and the doctor told John's father that if he didn't get out of that climate, that he would not survive. So at age two or so, John and his family, mother and father, moved to America. And they settled in Macon, Georgia, and John Birch was raised in Macon, Georgia. And he excelled in high school, graduated earlier than his peers, and went on to attend Mercer University there in Macon, and graduated from Macon, Georgia, Mercer University in 1939. And after his graduation from Mercer College, magna cum laude, he went to the Fort Worth Bible Baptist Institute for a year, 2 years training to be a missionary. He was able to complete the 2 years training in just 1 year, and then he decided his life's ambition was to be a missionary, and he surveyed the globe and decided that China is the part of the earth that needed missionaries most of all. So he decided to go to China to be a missionary, and he arrived in Shanghai Harbor, July 1940, and began his missionary career.
And now John had to live on the diet, the Chinese diet, which was kind of tough for someone, a Southern boy, to adapt. And he had to learn the Chinese language, which I think was Mandarin, which is not easy, again, for an Anglo-Saxon tongue or an American tongue to comprehend it. I've had some friends who have been missionaries to China over the years, and a few of them have been able to master the language. But that itself is an accomplishment, just learning to be able to speak Chinese.
Yes, according to my recollection, John accomplished the Mandarin language in about 7 months. And he was able to speak so well that they could not tell the difference between John or a nationalist Chinese speaking the Mandarin language. So that helped him immensely with his missionary work. Another interesting thing about John's missionary work was when he arrived in China, he immediately settled in with a missionary field group and was living in a missionary's house. But after he learned the language, he decided that kind of life, living in a house, was not his kind of missionary work that he wanted to do. So he decided to be a field missionary and live off the land, as you spoken about earlier, and he had to survive on meager Chinese diet. At that time, China was, of course, under almost all of eastern China was occupied by the Japanese Imperial Army. And in order to accomplish his missionary work and to help save souls and restore damaged, blown down congregations from the war, he had to go behind Japanese enemy lines, so to speak, during that time. And because of his fluency of the language and his ability to disguise himself, John, although Caucasian, he did have these sloping eyes, dark hair, so he actually...
And he was a slight of stature. What was his height? Leo, what was his height? He wasn't a very tall man, was he?
I believe he was about 5'9".
5'9". Well, that would be a little taller than the average Chinese at that time, I believe.
Yes, he was maybe a foot taller than most Chinese, but he was very, very cautious when he did his missionary work, and he was able to disguise himself as simply a Chinese nationalist, and was able to traverse the countryside and perform his missionary work.
And then, again, China, Japan was already at war with China, and then Pearl Harbor came around, which would be December 7th of 1941, and then a few days, within a day or so, the United States formally declared war. So now we're at war with China. And that probably, I know some of the missionaries went home, I think, but he stayed. And then the famous Doolittle bombing mission over Tokyo, and you want to pick it up from there and discuss his connections with Colonel, at the time, Colonel Doolittle.
Yes, it was April of 1942 when there was a bombing raid led by Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. And they bombed Tokyo, and because of their inability to get back to the aircraft carrier, they had to, Jimmy Doolittle's crew and many of the other crews had to ditch their planes in China and bail out and try to best they could to get to Allied operations. And it was during this time that while Jimmy Doolittle and his crew number one were secreted in a sampan banked on a river, that John came in contact with Doolittle. John was eating a meal in a Chinese restaurant, and he was approached by a Chinese nationalist. Came over to his table, bumped into him, and whispered down to him, if you are American, follow me. And so the Chinese left the restaurant, and John quickly followed after, and he was led down to this sampan moored on this river and approached the sampan and went up onto the sampan and knocked on the wooden door and said, any Americans in there? And he didn't hear any response. And so he banged on the door again, said, any Americans in there? And finally, they opened the door, and there was John Birch was looking at Colonel Jimmy Doolittle and his crew of five. And thanks to John's ability to know where he was and how to get to Allied operations, he was able to rescue Jimmy Doolittle and his crew and help them get back to Allied operations in Kunming, China.
One of the interesting little anecdote is that I think the crew members were a little cautious. They thought some Japanese may have learned English. But he had the southern drawl, and he said, no chap is going to sound that way. And I think one of them had the Lord's name in vain, and he said, that's a great name, but I'm not him.
And, yes. It was Paul, excuse me, it was Paul Leonard. I believe he was one of the gunners, I believe, on the Jimmy Doolittle's crew, and he heard John Birch and recognized it being American, and he said, Jesus Christ, just like that. And Birch said, well, wow, that's a mighty fine name, but I am not him. Oh, my gosh. But at any rate, it's a very interesting part of our history.
I had the privilege of meeting Robert Height, the co-pilot, probably in the – oh, it was 15 or 18 years ago, right in the wake of that movie Pearl Harbor came out, which there was about five or seven of the Doolittle Raiders that were at this gathering near Boston. And to a man, they didn't like the movie. They said that Colonel Doolittle was depicted as a vulgar, swearing, with vulgar language. And they said, Mr. Colonel Doolittle, he was a tough guy. He demanded a lot. He said, but he never used profanity at all. He was very clean cut about that. And I think just last year, the last of the Doolittle Raiders passed away.
It could be. Yes, it could very well be.
Did you interview? I don't recall. I've watched your documentary. I don't recall if you've interviewed any of the Doolittle Raiders.
I did. I interviewed Lieutenant Richard Cole, a crew member.
Oh, Dick Cole. I met him, too. Yeah.
And the navigator, Hank. Oh, gosh, I can't recall his name. Hank Potter, I believe it is. Potter? I interviewed the navigator and Lieutenant Richard Cole. They're part of the documentary film. Yeah.
So he led Doolittle and his crew to safety, and then it was he decided to join the Army. Those days it was called the U.S. Army Air Corps, and he wanted to be a chaplain, as I understood. But General Claire Chennault, who was his commander, said, I don't need chaplains, I need intelligence officers. So that's where you spent the rest of the war, mainly behind enemy lines, gathering information, rescuing downed pilots, etc. The 8th Air Force, was it called?
The 23rd Fighter Group of
the 23rd
14th
Fighter
Air
Group.
Force. 23rd Fighter Group of the 14th Air Force, yeah.
He was known as the Eyes of the 14th Air Force, I believe.
Yes, yes. Yes, an amazing young man. He struggled, I'm sure, to make that decision to turn in his missionary suit for an Army uniform, but thank God he did. He contributed immensely in the war effort, in the fight against Imperial Japan at that time.
And he was highly decorated, although he didn't really like necessarily, getting awards. He was decorated as a picture of him. There are not a whole lot of pictures of him during World War II, but there's a picture of him getting a medal pinned on him by General Chennault. And
yes.
Then take us to the war ended. The second bomb was dropped on Japan. And then there was a truce. I think the formal end of the war was September 2nd on the Big Mo, when it was a formal surrender. But they had surrendered. There was a truce. And so talk about the mission that John was on, his final mission, and what happened to him.
Yes, yes. A little bit of the backstory here. John's commander, General Claire Chennault, had actually been recalled in July of 1945 to Washington, D.C., so he was no longer commander of the 14th Air Force when John Birch went on his last secret mission in August of 1945. John was to meet up with his colleague, radio man, Lieutenant William Miller, in Suzhou. And we really don't know what he was there going to be going there for, because it was a secret mission. But he was to meet up with his radio man colleague, Lieutenant Bill Miller, in Suzhou, and they took different paths. Miller took the railway and directly to Suzhou, and John went by river. So at any rate, as John was leaving the river part of the journey and taking the road to Suzhou, he was with a group of 11, some Chinese officers that he was with, and there were two Korean officers, and Lieutenant Kwan Fu Tung, who was his aide. And they were, they had to traverse to Suzhou by rail part of the journey. So unfortunately, the rail had been destroyed by the communists, so the train that they were on could no longer navigate north, could no longer move northward. So what they did was they exited the train, took all of their gear, and put it on the side of the road, and they saw that this was after the truce, and they saw that some Japanese operators, construction people, and army officers had come down to that part of the rail that was destroyed, and they brought a lot of equipment with them, and they were repairing the rail. And they brought all of this equipment with them on a handrail car. So John immediately went over to the commanding Japanese officer and demanded to have that handrail car. And the Japanese officer reluctantly did give the handrail car to John Birch and his crew. They got on that rail car and started pumping that rail car going north hour after hour in that sweltering sun. And they had traversed so many miles, and they were approached by a hostile band of Chinese communist regular troops, several hundred of them. And to make a long story short, that group of Chinese troops, the officer there, they demanded that John turn over their weapons and their gear, and John, of course, refused and started scolding them, telling them, you know, what are you trying to do? The war is over. You should help us to maintain the peace. So on and so forth, and John was very angry at this point. And my research shows that this is what actually happened. There was John's belligerent attitude about not giving up his weapons and equipment, which of course was the right thing to do. So what happened was, John demanded to see the Chinese Communist commanding officer. And the communist who was in charge said, okay, you follow me. And John's aide, Lieutenant Quan Phu Tung, said, I will go with him to the Chinese Communist officer. And the officer said, okay, you two come with me. So it was John and his aide, Lieutenant Tung, who went into the hut of the communist commander. And John immediately went over to this communist commander and started berating him, just telling him, giving him all kinds of heck for his attitude towards Americans. And it was at that time that the commanding officer in that hut, he just pointed to his soldiers and said, shoot them. Mm. So they shot John Birch and his aide, Lieutenant Quan Phu Tung. And the reason we know this story to be true is because John Birch did not survive. He was murdered. He was killed. But Quan Phu Tung, he was injured. He gravely injured, but not fatally. So he was picked up and taken to a hospital, and he gave testimony to the U.S. Army Air Force about the death of Captain John Birch. And if you read that testimony, the reason that John took the attitude that he did, Quan Phu Tung told John, he said, don't argue, don't want to argue with these. John looked at Quan Phu Tung and said, I do not care what happens to me, but the people back home, they have to know what kind of people we are dealing with here. And that was what caused John's death.
And what's fascinating is that he was totally correct. The Chinese communists have always been our enemies. even when Nixon opened up relations with him, kicked out Taiwan out of the UN, and the goal was that if we're friendly with the Chinese communists, they'll be less aggressive, they'll be better, they'll be a better, everything will be great. We'll be able to get great products out of that country, and now look at the mess we're in. And not only have our policies helped destroy a lot of our industry, but of course they've murdered millions of their own people, genocide, and now the coronavirus, thanks to the Chinese communists and the people in this country who have this attitude that they're our friends and we can open up our borders and not worry about anything. So now we don't have a whole lot of time left. So you did this incredible documentary in 2003, and you interviewed people who knew John very well, members of his family. I think didn't he have a lady friend that they were getting serious with? She was a nurse, I believe.
Yes, her name is Dorothy Ewan, and she and John were good friends. She was actually became a radio operator for the 14th Air Force, and they got to know each other quite well. May I just say one final thing, Phil?
Oh, sure. Oh, no, we got a few minutes left.
Okay,
we got four
good.
Minutes
great.
Left, so, yeah.
All right, great. So, actually, what drove me to make the documentary film was the fact that back in 1992, I completed writing a screenplay, a feature film screenplay about Captain John Birch. I could never sell it to Hollywood. After 5 years of trying, in 1997, wow, I decided to make a documentary film about John Birch. And that's how I got started on the documentary film.
And that
but
was
I'm still,
quite an under- yeah.
I'm still trying this day to sell that screenplay to someone. So if it's allowed on your air show, I'll be glad to give folks my phone number, also agent's phone number.
Oh.
All right.
Oh,
good.
Absolutely. Yeah, please.
Anyone
yes.
who has any information, would like information about what we have been talking about here, they can call me at 801-703-3481. That is 801-703-3481. And I have a literary agent who has been helping me with the screenplay. His name is George Lilly. George Lilly. And his phone number, if you're interested, if there's anyone out there interested in the business side of the screenplay, you may call George at 303-550-9550. That's 303-550-9550.
And the listeners who didn't get the numbers, if you just contact me, I can give you Leo's contact information if for some reason you missed that. Let me also mention a couple of books on John Birch. And one of them, and I'm holding a copy in my hand, The Life of John Birch, which was written by Robert Welch, who was the founder of the John Birch Society. And there was another book that came out, I think, in the early 80s or late 70s. It was called The Secret File on John Birch, written by Mr. Heffley from Texas. He and his wife used to have a textbook committee where they would review the Texas textbooks for high schools and junior high schools. And he made this point, and initially when I heard it, I said, I don't know about that, but I agree with it now. He said that if the American people knew the truth about John Birch in the immediate aftermath of the murder, that there would not have been a Korean War and a Vietnam War. And I thought, you know something? We helped the communist, General Marshall, and the policy. Even John Kennedy, as a senator, complained about it. I think that may be true, that we would have not supported the Chinese communists. They would not have taken power. And we would not have had a Korean War and a Vietnam War. So I And those books are available on Amazon or other places, probably for short money. And I have some copies. If you contact me, I'll be able to get you, you know, make a donation, and I'll be able to get you some copies. Well, Leo, thank you so much for being on. And I wish
my
you,
pleasure.
I wish you success. I hope that somebody, I don't expect Hollywood to pick it up, but maybe some of these Christian independent film producers would. So with that, folks, you've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff, on WBCQ, The Planet. And until next week, may God richly bless you.